Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Hey, guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. Elena.
Hey.
Hey. I love your mic check. Hootie hoo. Okay, first things first. We have a little announcement. Cousins on Crime is turning one next week.
Can you believe it?
May 24th. I cannot believe. I don't know why. I think I was thinking June. Because I remember when we were in Vegas, I was like, okay, we've got to set a date. Let's just say June. And it ended up being like before June.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have something. Go ahead.
I was thinking the same thing. I thought it was in June. And then when I went back and looked at the first episode, it was May 24th. I was like, huh? So, this year has gone by so fast.
It has. And I'm not okay with it. I think it makes me feel uncomfortable, and it's weird, but as far as Cousins on Crime goes, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Time flies when you're having fun.
That's right.
So, we have something really cool planned for next week, so make sure you're subscribed to our show, so it'll just show up on your feed, and like, all of our episodes will just show up on your feed if you're subscribed. So, subscribe!
Don't miss it. Yeah.
Okay, second thing second, we have a lot to get to in this case, so I'm just going to take off my cover up and dive right into the water. Okay. I'm not even going to test it with my toe.
Okay, let's go.
I'm diving right in. Okay. Guys, take a potty break, maybe grab some milk duds, and have a seat. It's going to be a long one, but we're going to get through it. Okay. So just before 3 p.m. on July 29th, I told you I was going to jump right in. July 29th, 1999, a man walked through the front doors of a place called Alltech Investment Group in Atlanta, Georgia. It was a day trading company, and he approached the office manager. Does this sound familiar to you?
No. At first, I thought it was something I've heard before, but no, it's not.
Well, you may remember this. Okay. But we were kids. So after a brief exchange with the office manager, he knocked on the office window next door to a guy named Brent Doonan, and he was an executive there. He just waved at him. Brent was on the phone, but he was like, just a minute. So he actually thought that this man was bringing in some more money so he could do some more trading that day. And when he went out to the hall to greet the man, he realized something was a very, very wrong.
Uh-oh.
The man's jovial demeanor sort of shifted and a callousness came over his face. And he said, "Today is going to be visual."
Okay.
And just then, he pulled out two handguns and began shooting. He fired at Brent at close range, shooting him. He fired at a few more staffers nearby.
Oh my God.
Brent, having fallen to the floor at that point, realized he'd been shot in the chest and the arm. So he tried to get to safety by hiding behind the wall of his office.
Okay.
Like, he went right inside. And like I said, he had this big glass window that the guy had knocked on.
Right.
You know, so he's like hiding behind a piece of the wall.
Oh my gosh.
At this point, he's like, I can't stay in here because I'm kind of cornered. So I need to get out of here. So he emerged into the hallway to find a way out. And he was shot a couple more times.
Oh my gosh.
Like the guy was standing right there. It was unavoidable, but he knew he had to at least try to get to safety. Because if the guy came into his office, he was cornered.
Right.
He was just going to finish him off. So he didn't know it then. But by the time he made it to the service elevator and frantically pushed the buttons and the door closed, he had been shot five times by that point. Meanwhile, the shooter had pivoted from the front offices to a trading room nearby full of people at terminals trading stocks, and he calmly said, I hope I'm not upsetting your training day. It was pure chaos. People were diving under the terminal desks and taking cover where they could, some running out nearby doors.
Wow.
Someone even threw a computer through a window to try and escape out the window.
Okay, was it a second story?
It was actually on the third floor.
Okay, wow.
While the victims of the crime were in disarray and scrambling, witnesses would later describe the shooter as being very calm during this time. By the time the shots had stopped, five people were dead.
Wow.
The man exited the building and he walked across the parking lot. He got into his green minivan and off he went into the Atlanta traffic. Now, calls to 911 had already started flooding in, but dispatchers became confused because the first calls were coming in with reports from an active shooter at Momentum Securities, which is another day trading firm in the Piedmont Center office complex just across the street from Alltech Investment Groups. The shooting had actually begun there.
Oh.
Yeah. And four people had died in that attack.
Oh my gosh.
So as the dispatchers were, you know, directing authorities on where to go, they were confused, like, do you go there or do you go there?
Right.
And the truth was they needed to go both places at the same time. So authorities wasted no time descending on the Piedmont Center area. They were there in 4 minutes.
Whoa.
And they had over six police units. They fanned out. They were going floor by floor, clearing rooms and evacuating office workers. In a matter of minutes, I think one witness said that the whole place was like locked down in 11 minutes. They really, people praised them for their action that day.
Sounds like they did a great job.
Unfortunately, by the time they cleared everything, a total of 9 people were dead.
Yeah, I mean, there's not, I mean, when you have someone in a rage, you can't stop them from, I mean,
of course.
4 minutes, a lot can happen in 4 minutes, but I mean,
they did save lives. I mean, there were other people injured that they were rushed to the hospital and stuff. But I just wanted to talk about, I know there's 9 people that were victims. I just wanted to quickly touch on each victim.
Okay.
So one of the victims, Dean Delawalla, I hope I'm saying that right. He was 62. He was originally from Pakistan, but came to the U.S. in 1973. He was married with 2 children. Vadawadi Muraladara, I hope I'm saying that right. I'm sorry. She was 44. She left behind a 17-year-old son, and her family was just crushed. They actually had been trying to reach her all afternoon when the police showed up at their home.
Oh, no.
I mean, Edward Quinn was 58. He worked as an executive with the U.S. Parcel Service, but was recently retired. And he just enjoyed day trading. It was just somewhat of a hobby of his. He was married with 3 grown children, and he had just welcomed his first grandchild like 3 weeks before that.
Oh, my goodness.
Charles Allen Tenenbaum was 48. He owned a grocery store in Atlanta. He loved to golf and was an avid jogger. He jogged at least 4 miles a day.
Oh, that's tough.
I mean, I know. He was president of his synagogue, and he was married with 3 children. Scott Webb was 30. He was just 30. I mean, so he wasn't married, didn't have a family, but he did leave behind his parents and sister. He had nieces and nephews, cousins, a great big family that would miss him deeply. Kevin Dial was 38. Kevin had an inoperable brain tumor at the time of his murder. He was taking medication to prevent seizures, it was kind of at bay, and there was really nothing they could do for him. But he had just moved to Atlanta from Texarkana, Texas. He was the office manager at Momentum Securities, and he was just there to open the new branch, which I just can't even. Jamshid Havash was 44. He was married, and his wife and daughter were actually in Iran visiting family at the time he was killed, and they didn't know he was dead until 6 days later when they got home.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Family, apparently, in Atlanta did not want to contact them while they were gone because there was just nothing that they could do, and they didn't want to... I don't know. I have mixed feelings about that.
Yeah, but that's a tough decision.
That's what happened. So Russell Brown was 42. He left behind a girlfriend and his mother. He'd recently lost his dad and brother like less than 2 weeks apart. And he had a cat named, get this, Sweetie McMack McSchminkle Toast Magoo.
I love it. I had a coworker that had a cat with all kinds of names.
I love it so much. And actually, in his will, Sweetie McMack McSchminkle Toast Magoo was the first person in his will.
Oh, so my goodness.
He loved that cat.
That's cute.
He actually got that cat after his brother died, or his dad died, sorry. And so he just loved that cat. No. It was like... and then the last victim was Joseph Desert, 60 years old. And I'm so sad to say I couldn't find any information on this victim other than like on findagrave.com. Mm-hmm. His parents were already dead when he died. I couldn't find any information anywhere on this guy, but rest in peace, Joseph. And to all the other victims.
Yes.
Now, the remaining victims were injured in the attack. There were 13 of them, and they were all taken to a few different local hospitals in the area. You know, when something like this happens, they don't want to overwhelm one hospital with many, like, you know, critical cases. So they kind of divide them up. So some were in critical condition, some were stable but needed surgery, and one lady was actually shot in the back, but she was treated and released really quickly, so she wasn't super injured. One survivor, Kathy Van Camp, was shot in the face.
Oh, my Lord.
And she survived, but she ended up losing her sight, her sense of taste, and smell.
Wow.
And any hope for a normal future, pretty much. Witnesses tried to provide authorities with a description of the shooter, and of course there were varying accounts, like there always is with eyewitnesses. And basically what he was wearing at the time, they were trying to describe, oh, he was wearing an orange shirt, no, it was pink, he was wearing khaki pants, no, they were shorts.
Oh.
So some witnesses actually recognized the man, and as we know, Brent Doonan knew who he was, but he was getting worked on. So,
because Brent thought he was there for work, and so
exactly.
Okay, that makes sense.
And we'll learn more about this guy, but witnesses had identified him as Mark Oren Barton.
Okay.
And get this: when he pulled out those guns, and even while he was shooting, people thought he was joking. They knew him to be, like, a nice guy. He had He joked with people, so they thought this was a prank. And that's horrifying, because people were just standing there like,
oh my gosh,
what are you doing? You know, not like taking cover immediately, thinking it was an immediate
threat. In danger, yeah.
Now, they got Mark's driver's license, so what he was wearing was not really that important. And they blasted it out to the media. They also had a description of his vehicle. Like I said, he was driving his family's dark green Ford minivan.
Mm-hmm.
The perfect getaway car for a mass murder, if you ask me. Unless the police are looking for you in a dark green minivan. So, at this time, the largest manhunt Atlanta had ever seen was underway. Police needed to get to Mark's home, and quick. Mm-hmm. They didn't know where he was going, or like how much ammunition he had, if he was planning to go somewhere else and shoot even more people. And even though investigators had just seen the carnage that Mark had left behind, they were not prepared for what they would find back at Mark's house. They could never have anticipated what they would find there. The apartment was pretty tidy, but as they made their way from room to room, they found Mark's two children, 10-year-old Matthew and 8-year-old Michelle, both bludgeoned to death in their beds.
Oh my gosh.
The children had been positioned in their beds as if they were just sleeping. He just positioned them, covered them back up. Each of them had a handwritten note on their bodies. I don't know what those particular notes said, but later they found Mark's wife, Leanne, dead in the master closet, and she also had a note nearby. Now, from the state of the bodies, they knew immediately that they had to have been dead for some time, and they confirmed this by finding one last note, a longer one, that was on the computer, and it read, July 29th, 1999, 6:38 a.m., to whom it may concern. Leanne is in the master closet under a blanket. I killed her on Tuesday night. I killed Matthew and Michelle Wednesday night. There may be similarities between these deaths and the death of my first wife, Deborah Spivey. However, I deny killing her and her mother. There's no reason for me to lie now. It just seemed like a quiet way to kill and a relatively painless way to die. There was little pain. All of them were dead in less than 5 minutes. I hit them with a hammer in their sleep and then put them face down in the bathtub to make sure they did not wake up in pain. To make sure they were dead. I am so sorry. I wish I didn't. Words cannot tell the agony. Why did I? I have been dying since October. I wake up at night so afraid, so terrified that I couldn't be that afraid while awake. It has taken its toll. I have come to hate this life and this system of things. I have come to have no hope. I killed the children to exchange them for 5 minutes of pain for a lifetime of pain. I forced myself to do it to keep them from suffering so much later. No mother, no father, no relatives. The fears of the father are transferred to the son. It was from my father to me, and from me to my son. He already had it, and now to be left alone, I had to take him with me. I killed Leanne because she was one of the main reasons for my demise, and I planned to kill the others. I really wish I hadn't killed her now. She really couldn't help it, and I loved her so much anyway. I know the Jehovah will take care of all of them in the next life. I'm sure the details don't matter. There's no excuse, no good reason. I am sure no one will understand. If they could, I wouldn't want them to. I just write these things to say why. Please know that I love Leanne, Matthew, and Michelle with all of my heart. If Jehovah is willing, I would like to see all of them again in the resurrection, to have a second chance. I don't plan to live very much longer, just long enough to kill as many of the people that greedily sought my destruction. You should kill me if you can. Mark O. Barton. Oh,
greedily sought his destruction.
Yeah. So why did he do this? What would possess a person to carry out such a heinous act on the public and their family, right?
Right.
And more specifically on these day trading firms. What did they have to do with anything? So that's where the authorities start, because stocks and trading seem to be a point of contention with this guy.
Mm-hmm.
They learned that Mark had recently had some financial losses, some investments. Mark was 44 years old, and he had worked as a chemist until he quit and started day trading full-time. Kind of ballsy, if you ask me. I knew nothing about stocks and trading before researching this case. I won't bore you with too much detail, but let me just give you a bit of information, because just so you can see the perspective of his risk-taking behaviors before this attack.
Gotcha.
So day trading stocks has been around since the 1960s. By the 1980s, electronic trading was emerging, and in the 90s, brought online trading. So when the World Wide Web, you know, was fresh out of the oven, you remember those AOL CDs where it would have like 120 hours for free, and you had to put it into your CD drive, type in like this little code, and then wait for the dial-up. That's kind of how it was.
Okay.
Kids, y'all don't even know. Don't know how good you have it. You have the internet in your pocket these days. Anyways, trading floors became these rooms of like computers all next to each other, kind of like computer class in school.
Oh, okay.
Kids these days will also not know what we're talking about. But people would be sitting at these computers all day trading stocks. And Mark had been trading stocks at Alltech for about a year. He also had spent some time at Momentum Securities as well. But like the other day traders, he would buy and sell small quantities of volatile stocks to make a quick profit. Some of these stocks were bought and sold within the day. Some were bought and sold like a minute later. It was just sort of like a game. There was skill involved, but also a lot of luck, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could never tell how the stocks were like fluctuating, unless you were involved in insider trading. But basically, it was risky, obviously.
Yeah.
Because if you lose big, and you're in the negative. A lot of people lose their first time at trading stocks and they'll give up.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of people will give up because they're like, crap, I just lost $5,000.
Yeah, it's scary.
I can't afford to lose $5,000. A lot of people can't afford to lose that kind of money.
Right.
So they can take bigger risks. Well, Mark had not just been trading on his own dime. He was actually involved in some partnerships where people pull their money together so they can buy more and profits could potentially be more. However, those investments weren't profitable.
Oh.
They were just losses on an even bigger scale. So the head of Alltech, Harvey Houtkin, compared day trading to using a high-powered rifle, saying, if you use it right, you'll be able to hunt effectively and bring down a nice buck. But if you don't know what you're doing, you'll probably blow your head off.
Oh.
I think that's a bit...
excessive.
Poor choice of an analogy, you know, especially dramatic. Given what had just happened.
Yeah.
But a lot of people lose money in the stock market, and they don't go on murderous rampages. So let's rewind for a minute. We need to go back to the unfortunate day of Mark's birth, which was April 2nd, 1955. It was an unfortunate day. He grew up in Sumter, South Carolina, and his parents were Truman and Gladys Barton, but he had no siblings. He was an only child. Truman Barton was in the Air Force, and his mother was said to be very religious by neighbors. Little is known about the true family dynamic. Mm. I read a couple places that he and his father had some sort of volatile relationship, which is kind of alluded to in his
letter,
quote-unquote suicide note. But I couldn't substantiate it, but I felt like it was worth mentioning because, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire,
right,
type of thing. And his mother refused to speak to anyone about Mark, you know, after this happened. So she's taking whatever happened to her grave.
Hmm.
Mark didn't make much of an impression on his classmates at his time at Sumter High School. When reporters with the Washington Post contacted over 2 dozen classmates,
wow,
to interview them after this shooting, none of them remembered him.
Oh, wow.
In fact, his photo was missing from the yearbook the year he graduated.
What?
I don't know why. It just wasn't there. He wasn't involved in any extracurricular activities or school clubs.
So maybe he was just a
fat loser.
Yeah, like a quiet guy. Like, behind the scenes,
just
lurking in the hallways.
Exactly. Now, back to the day of the spree killing. 5 hours after the attack in Buckhead, police located Mark driving his minivan and trailed behind him until they could positively ID him. They didn't want to spook him, you know, if he saw them. They didn't want any more lives to be lost, so they didn't want this to turn into a high-speed chase or anything like that, so they quietly trailed him. Luckily, Mark turned into a BP gas station in Cobb County, Georgia.
Hmm.
He did a couple laps around the parking lot, kind of going behind the building and then coming back around and stopping near the car wash. And just after 8 p.m., Corporal Curtis Endicott pulled his car in front of Mark's car to kind of block him from leaving the parking lot. And as he exited his vehicle, he saw a flash and heard a muffled pop.
Oh.
Mark had shot himself.
Mm.
In the car, they found 4 handguns.
Wow.
And more than 200 rounds of ammunition. And we've seen this before in mass shootings, when a perpetrator kills themselves because they're too much of a coward to face what they've done.
Right.
They don't want to relive it. They don't want to talk about it. They'd just rather end things on their terms and not have to hear about their crimes in court or hear from the victim's families.
Exactly.
But were his financial losses enough to make him snap? You know, I wondered. I was like, where did Mark get all of this money to invest in stocks? I mean, no doubt he made good money as a chemist back in the day. Not sure about his sales job, but his losses were in the $100,000, like hundreds of thousands of dollars. Lena, would you like to venture a guess as to where he got all that money?
Okay, so earlier you said that he, in the letter, he talked about killing Deborah Spivey, his ex-wife.
Hmm.
He got her life insurance.
You were listening. Well, I'll tell you. He got a settlement with an insurance company in the amount of $600,000. You see, this insurance company had refused to pay the life insurance policy that he had on his first wife, Deborah, when she was brutally murdered.
Okay.
Mark and his first wife, Deborah Spivey, married in 1979. They met at the University of South Carolina, where Mark graduated with a degree in chemistry. They lived in Atlanta for a little bit before moving to Texarkana, Texas, where Mark founded a company called TLC Manufacturing, and he was the president of that company. In 1990, Mark was essentially fired from the company. I don't know the details as to what went down, but he had started this company with some friends of his.
Oh.
And something went sour. I can imagine what, just given who this guy is.
Gotcha.
But they booted him from the company. Well, mysteriously, the day after Mark was fired, someone broke into the offices and stole some proprietary information, mm-hmm. like secret formulas, and then erased a bunch of computer files.
Ooh.
So Mark was actually arrested for burglary after that, but the TLC board members dropped the charges against him, saying that they had reached an outside agreement with him.
Hmm.
You know, these were his friends. I'm sure they were like, you know, he's disgruntled, he's upset, whatever. For whatever reason, they didn't press charges. Wish they would have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So after this fallout, Mark and Deborah moved to Georgia, where Mark changed careers and took a job as a salesman for a chemical company. Same field, but now he's selling chemicals instead of formulating them. Seems like he was a little bit overqualified for this position, but to each their own.
Mm-hmm.
And by now, he and Deborah had two young children, Matthew and Michelle.
Mm.
So what happened to Deborah? Well, it was Labor Day weekend, 1993. Deborah and her mother, Eloise Spivey, took off in Eloise's red Thunderbird and headed to Lake Wise in Alabama to spend the weekend. Deborah's parents had actually purchased a campground lot years before this, and the family spent a lot of time there. They loved to camp, and specifically, they loved to fish. They were like avid fishers. The women planned to head home early Sunday morning, but when their car was still parked next to the camper late into the morning, the neighboring campers thought that was a little bit strange, so they went over to check on them, and as they started up to the front door, they were horrified at what they saw. Blood. I'm not sure if there was blood on the outside of the camper, or if they peered in the window,
mm-hmm.
but they immediately called Cherokee County Police. And when the police responded to the scene, it was like something out of a horror movie.
There was
blood covering the interior, the walls, the ceiling. It had clearly been a violent, anger-fueled attack.
Mm-hmm.
The two women were found brutally hacked to death in the camper.
Oh, no.
The weapon was never found, but authorities described their injuries as being consistent with something axe-like, like a heavy, sharp weapon. Now, when police called Bill Spivey, Eloise's husband and Deborah's father, they wouldn't give him any information over the phone. They just said, "Get here immediately." And he knew something was going on. So he gathered his son, John, and Mark Barton, and they raced to Wise Lake. When they arrived, Bill said that instead of Mark asking investigators, "What happened?" You know, your immediate, mm-hmm. what you would immediately say, like, "Why are we here? What happened?" He kind of looked around at the trees and went, "I've never been here." That really struck Bill as odd.
Yeah.
And made him really uncomfortable. The three men were separated at that time and questioned individually until long after dark. Now, family immediately pointed to Mark as the murderer. Deborah's cousin said that Mark was cooler than a cucumber at the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
Investigators actually said, you know, because they attended the funeral, they're always attending funerals, seeing what's going on. And they just said Mark was stone-faced the whole time, showing no emotion. And, you know, while we can't always read into that, it does matter.
Yeah.
You know. Oh, and one more thing. He brought his new girlfriend,
Leanne,
with him to the funeral.
Shut your mouth.
I will not. I still have 5 more pages of notes. I will not shut my mouth. So he was the prime suspect in the murders. The one and only suspect, actually. But they never arrested him.
Why?
So while they were married for years, I will get to why. But that life insurance policy that was taken out on Deborah, it was taken out on her just weeks before the murders. Weeks.
Yeah, doesn't surprise me.
They were married for years. Like, why wasn't it just a policy that they had always had? Well, the district attorney in Alabama at the time, Richard Igu, I don't know if I'm saying that right, but he sounds like a douchebag, so I don't really care. He said that Mark was interrogated and they gathered as much evidence as they possibly could, but they're just, you know, it just never amounted to enough for an indictment. Captain Jerry Wynn with the Douglas County Sheriff's Office in Georgia said that's nonsense. Mm-hmm. He believed they did have enough evidence to take him to court, circumstantial as it may have been. Mm-hmm. Remember, Deborah and her mom were killed in Alabama, but they lived in Georgia.
Okay.
So you had 2 different states involved. Right. And I feel like this never works out. It either becomes a pissing contest, right, and that gets in the way of justice, you know, or one bureau will pass off things to the next thinking, oh, they're going to investigate that. They're going to follow up on that lead. And then the ball gets dropped.
Right.
Too many cooks in the kitchen. Now, Captain Wynn said that Alabama dropped the ball on the case. Mm. And he even went on to tell CNN, if they had done their jobs, maybe 12 people wouldn't be dead today.
Oh, man.
So Captain Wynn describes the evidence that they had against Mark. Okay, here it goes. A camper said that they saw a man fitting Mark's description, asking for directions to the lake just hours before the murders. But this witness was never brought in to ID anybody. No lineup, no follow-up, nothing. The scene was meant to appear like a robbery gone wrong. Some rings were taken, but an envelope sitting there with like $700 in cash wasn't taken. There was other jewelry left behind. There was no forced entry. Alabama police actually took the floor mats out of Mark's car. The floor mats. Why?
Yeah, why?
Why just the floor mats? Anyway, they took his floor mats to test them. But they said, you know, take your car and just hang on to it. We'll be back, you know, in a couple of days to test the rest. Just don't clean it.
Yeah, don't do anything.
Don't clean it or anything. We'll be back. Well, he did clean it. Okay.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, because when Georgia police heard of this, they raced over to get his car. They were like, no, that's not how that works. Now, he had it thoroughly cleaned. Specifically, he had his gas and brake pedals cleaned and conditioned with Armor All.
Wow.
They did detect blood on the steering wheel, the gear shift, and the driver's door. And they found blood in Mark's home, in the kitchen, bathroom, and the garage. However, the samples they found were very small. They weren't large enough to collect DNA, so no further tests were done. And you know, back in the early 90s, you had to have a significantly larger blood sample than you do these days. Right. I mean, these days you could have touch DNA for crying out loud.
Yeah.
So they didn't collect the evidence. They just said, oh, these samples are too small. So I guess we'll just move on.
So disappointing.
I know. But there was more damning evidence, though. Circumstantial, but still, we know that that's important too. The life insurance policy, of course, but also Mark's co-workers said that Mark had been saying he and Leanne would be together by October.
Oh, so Leanne was the girlfriend that came to the funeral? Leanne.
Mark refused a polygraph test, and he forbid Leanne to speak with investigators. Mark's alibi for the night of the murders was also very flimsy. He said he was at home with the kids all night. Well, investigators said he had plenty of time to drive from his home while the children were sleeping to the campground, commit the murders, and return before the children woke up. I mapped it, and it's like from Lithia Springs, Georgia, where he was living at the time, to Lake Weiss is about an hour and a half.
Okay.
And the way I drive, I could have probably got there in an hour and 15. So he could have also. And though there was that one witness who described the guy asking for directions, it was a really crowded weekend. There were about 500 campers. It was Labor Day weekend. There was like live music. People are grilling out. You know how, you know, it's like, I don't know, Coachella for campers. I don't know. But it's absolutely possible he could have slipped in there, committed the murders, and slipped out without making a spectacle of himself, you know?
But how close were they to other campers that, I mean, if they
screamed? Pretty close. I mean, pretty close.
Like, so do you think they screamed?
Close enough.
Nobody said anything about hearing screams?
You know, the thing is, when you know your killer, and this is kind of like, this is kind of the same thing with the spree killing. They didn't find him threatening even when he pulled out the guns. You know, I think most people don't, it takes a minute to register. Yeah. Most people assume that people are not there to harm them. Right. You know, unless you're me. And I'm like,
everybody,
you have a pin in your hand. Ah, oh, you're going to stab me in the jugular. No, but like, If he went to the campground and was like, hey, ladies, and they're like, oh, hey, you know,
what are you doing
if he
here?
Went in and he had an axe.
Yeah.
I mean, that's he only had to swing that thing twice to knock them both down. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But here I am thinking he hits one. The other one screams like, but maybe it was just like, bam, bam. I don't know.
Or just like, what are you doing? Or no,
yeah.
Or, you know, but the live music.
Well, yeah, true. Okay.
Nobody heard anything. So, what do you think, Lena? Everything I just told you, the blood's, you know, all over the house, pretty much, all over the car. He was a chemist, okay? He knew how to clean.
True.
Do you think that was enough to convict?
Well,
the circumstantial, like, all that stuff.
To convict, I mean, the witness saying they saw him, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Let me put it this way. Your case last week.
Yeah.
Okay? There was no blood, no gun, no physical evidence. All they had was her being weird, you know, the moving truck.
I mean, but when you added mattress, it all together, there was a lot of circumstantial. And so here,
So you've,
someone saw him and
The life insurance policy.
The life insurance and cleaning the vehicle.
Cleaning when he was specifically told not to.
Yeah. I mean, that's very suspicious.
Refusing a polygraph, refusing your partner, your new girlfriend, by the way, to speak with police. I say, let the jury decide.
Absolutely.
Alabama had obviously washed their hands of this case. They had obviously said, well, we don't have enough.
Mm-mm.
You know, Captain Wynn kind of joked after the mass killing and said that he wished, you know, he tried to get them to do like a fake raid on Mark's house.
Oh.
To kind of strike some fear in him or make him think that they had something
on him. Gotcha.
And he said that he thinks that Mark would have just killed himself right there.
Oh, probably.
If they staged kind of extreme, but looking back, he probably would have.
Yeah.
To avoid being accountable for that crime. And then the Buckhead Massacre, Leanne and the children would still be alive.
Or he just, maybe at that time, he just thought he was too smooth. Like, he thought he had this in the bag.
I guess. The vibe I get from all the interviews is that Alabama, like the DA, was just like, eh, you know, we just don't have enough.
But, you know, these court systems, they get inundated with case after case. So it's like, maybe they, I mean, I can't speak for them, but maybe it's just like, that's just another case that we can't.
Yeah. And then you've got Georgia that's like, those are our people. Like,
yeah,
the crime may have been committed there, but those are our people and we want justice.
Yeah.
And they weren't willing to give up. Like, he kept working on that case even until Mark's suicide.
Wow.
Why didn't Alabama take the lead on that? I mean, it was committed there.
Yeah, they should have. I mean, who am I? But I feel like it.
I know. Who am I? I just think that had they done the lineup and had Mark ID'd, and you know, we know eyewitness testimony is very flimsy and it's not often reliable. But that would have just been one more piece of the puzzle.
For sure.
Well, and the other thing is his car. Had they confiscated the entire car, maybe they would have found physical evidence.
Don't just let them go and say, don't clean it. That just boggles my mind.
It really does. I think they could have taken a risk. You know, the risk is, well, we can't try him again. If he's acquitted, we can't try him again.
Hmm.
Well, on the other hand, like, let the jury decide, take the risk.
Yeah.
Because this is obviously a violent person.
Yeah.
And now we see what happens. Well, Mark, his trouble with the law was not exclusive to suspicion of that murder of Deborah and her mother. Because the following year, in 1994, a daycare worker reported that Michelle said that her daddy had sexually molested her.
Oh my gosh.
She was 2.5 at the time.
Wow.
And there was an investigation. And part of that process was that Mark was required to undergo psychological evaluations. One psychologist concluded that he was certainly capable of homicidal violence. But given Michelle's age, it was very difficult for them to gather sufficient evidence to build a case against him. So prosecutors and psychologists were very concerned for the children's welfare.
But they didn't take the kids away.
The thing is in the eyes of the law, you have to have documentable proof.
Well, yeah.
It's not about gut feelings.
Right.
You know, a judge can't say, well, I just have a feeling. Maybe a judge can do that. But a psychologist, like, they gave their feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just chilling because it's like another thing slipped through the cracks. I don't know if he did molest her. 2.5. This is why when I went into psychology, I did not want to work with children because it's confusing.
Yeah.
My 3-year-old will tell me something that happened. She told me about an orange tunnel and she went and got Starburst. And like, I was like, did you have a dream? You know, it's just like pieces of things that they've seen or they, you know, daddy washed me or something. You know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
That could be misconstrued. So I don't want to take that away from Michelle at all.
Right.
I don't know. But it's very... It's
in the eyes of the law, you can't just say, okay, this 2.5-year-old is saying this. So it's
exactly.
Yeah.
So it's really difficult. That's a tough one. But Mark married Leanne just a little over a year after Deborah was murdered. And he blocked Deborah's family from any contact with the children.
Well, I'm sure.
And yeah. And the Spivey family actually took him to court, and a custody battle ensued. But ultimately, Mark won sole custody of the children. Smart. Because, again, no documentable proof.
Smart.
Now, if you're thinking that he sure did get married pretty quickly, that would be because Mark and Leanne began their relationship while they were married to other people. They met at the chemical company where Mark was a salesman. And you probably have already put this together. Leanne was a receptionist. Leanne reportedly was very vocal about how unhappy she was in her marriage at the time. And she really liked older men. And Mark was older. Meanwhile, Mark was buying really nice clothes all of a sudden. He was at the fake and bake getting a tan. And Deborah noticed. She was like, you don't look good as an Oompa Loompa. I don't know why you're tanning. He probably had one of those orange Playboy bunny stickers on his lower back. Do you remember those stickers? Mine was a butterfly. Anyway, Deborah was suspicious. And in a later deposition, Mark said that she was always suspicious of him having an affair. And, you know, he was in sales, meeting a lot of people, blah, 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 blah. You know, just like, I'm just a, you know, big dill.
Oh, pickle. Please.
No, she wasn't just suspicious, Mark. She was onto you.
She did not
she
trust
knew
you
were
you
cheating.
For a good reason.
Exactly. Cheaters always love to gaslight, don't they? Now, Mark and Leanne grew more careless in their affair. They went on a trip to Charlotte, North Carolina to visit Leanne's friends at one point, and Mark told them that he would be free to marry her by October.
Free to marry.
What's in October, Mark?
Right.
Is that after September, which is Labor Day? Yeah, that's because you planned to murder your wife in September.
Absolutely.
It's rather flamboyant to tell multiple people that you're going to marry your mistress.
Right.
Like, he told his coworkers, he told her friends, while you're still married to your wife. That's okay. Now, when Deborah was murdered, less than a month later, Leanne left the home she shared with her husband. And her ex-husband, David Lang, said that he came home one day after work and all her stuff was gone. He was just like, okay. And I don't know if he knew of the affair. Maybe he was suspicious, but she just left him. And police contacted David Lang to see if he could provide them any information as to Leanne's whereabouts on that particular night that Deborah and her mother were murdered. David, he didn't know because he actually worked nights at Boeing, so he couldn't really say what she was doing.
Okay.
Now, interestingly, David learned from the authorities that Leanne had taken out a life insurance policy on him.
Shut your mouth.
I couldn't find any more information about this.
Oh my gosh.
Coincidence. I'm using air quotes.
Yeah.
But David was never murdered, luckily. So either
there was
it really
plan.
Just was that a coincidence, or there was a plan and Mark thought, you know, I just got away with murder. I'll call it a day.
Yeah.
You know, let's not do one more. Let's just...
What in the world?
I know. Very, very strange. By 1997, that's when Mark won this life insurance payout.
Okay.
Because remember, this insurance company refused to pay because he was under suspicion.
Yeah.
And that's what they do. They're like, no,
I'm
paying you.
Hold on for a second.
The money. So he took them to court and they ended up settling for the $600,000 payout. But they ordered him to put $150,000 of it in a trust for the children. So it was shortly after this windfall in 1998 that Mark quit his job as a salesman and started day trading full time. And he did well at first. I mean, he got a little too big for his britches. Started making more and more, you know, larger investments, more risks. And he ended up losing an estimated $105,000 on internet stocks by June 1999, which was just the month before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this loss got Mark into some trouble with Alltech. I watched this documentary where Brent Noonan was interviewed about this whole day. And he said that he employed Mark. I don't know how that works. Mm. I don't know if day traders are considered employees, because I think, and I probably should have looked more into this, but it was boring to me. I didn't spend too much of my time looking into stocks and stuff, but apparently, they borrow money against the company. Alltech was a trading firm that he was trading at. So when he lost this money, they ended up closing his trading account the Tuesday before the killing spree, which was 2 days later on the Thursday, because he didn't have enough money to cover the margin call. And this is the cash that a trader has to be able to put up to cover the debt from like falling stock prices.
Okay.
So it's like a buffer. Remember what happened Tuesday? According to the note he left at home, he killed his wife that day.
Yes.
So he saw the walls closing in on him.
Mm-hmm.
And he and Leanne had not long reconciled before this. And now he's really screwed up and lost access to trading altogether, which to him cuts off access to him regaining his losses. In order to reopen his account at Alltech, he was required to give a $50,000 check to regain his access.
Okay.
So he wrote them that check, but it bounced. So he wasn't allowed to trade the following day, which was Wednesday. So his account access is closed Tuesday.
Okay.
He kills his wife.
Yeah.
He hid her body in a closet so the children wouldn't see. Writes them a $50,000 check. Now his check bounces. So he kills his children Wednesday. Well, he wakes up Thursday, July 29th, completely void of everything he's worked hard for his whole life. He had murdered his whole family. He had financial losses upward of $300,000 total in the past year.
Wow.
What's that like?
Right.
He had nothing else to lose at that point. So, according to one of the notes he left behind, he was angry at the other day traders because he blamed them for his demise.
Right.
Well, he also blamed Leanne.
Yeah.
Most news sources would end their reporting on this case by saying, we may never know why he did this. And I totally understand that most people will never be able to make sense of this in their brains. But to me, it's obvious.
Mm-hmm.
He was a ticking time bomb.
Yeah.
He was a family annihilator.
Yeah.
And two of the biggest factors, and Lena, we've talked about this, you know, in the Murdoch case, you have family breakdown. That's the first factor. The second leading cause of family annihilators is financial problems.
Right.
Specifically, the appearance of a family breakdown with regards to marriage and losing it all, finances, all of that.
Right, but not to mention also a similarity to the Murdoch murders is the repeated offense of, you know, you did something and you got away with it.
Exactly.
So let's do it again.
Exactly. Yes. And I'm not sure of what their financial situation was at the time of Deborah's murder. But remember, he had been fired from a company that he helped start. So he went from chemist to salesman. And for someone with his personality type, that knocks you down a couple pegs, you know? When it comes to pride and confidence in something that you've worked hard for. But, you know, Mark and Leanne's relationship wasn't all roses either. They did live happily after their marriage for a couple years. But it's reported that Leanne actually wanted a divorce before the murders, and they separated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mark had some strong ideals, and he wanted her to become a Jehovah's Witness. She was like, no, not doing that. Leanne moved out and got an apartment of her own.
Oh.
But they soon reconciled. And Mark and the children moved into the apartment with her and out of their house that they had been renting.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why. Probably financial reasons.
I'm sure.
I mean, he was losing a lot of money. He was losing money hand over fist.
Yeah.
I mean, he was hemorrhaging money. One report said that a friend of Leanne's actually stated that Leanne really just wanted to keep an eye on the children.
Yeah.
She didn't really want to get back with Mark. She wanted them back in her home.
Oh, man.
Because she wanted to make sure they were okay.
She knew what he was capable of.
Exactly. Well, she knew because she was with him when Deborah and her mother-in-law were his mother-in-law were murdered. Now, no information was given to say why she felt this way, but we know why.
Yeah.
She lived with him. She knew this man.
Yeah.
And she probably knew more and more and more of him as the years went on.
Mm-hmm.
And just a month after that, Leanne and the children would be dead. And when friends and family were interviewed in order to try and make sense of this tragedy for themselves, I mean, everybody's always trying to make sense of it, they sort of came up empty every time. Their neighbors in that apartment complex said that they kind of knew the family, but they really knew the children.
Oh.
Because the children were always over at different neighbors' houses, and the dad was kind of withdrawn.
Oh.
But one neighbor, Cindy Northcutt, said that, you know, Michelle was just a sweet little girl. She was gorgeous, always had her little cat with her.
Oh.
I wonder what her cat's name was.
Yeah.
And Matthew was really into his video games, less into socializing. He was kind of withdrawn too, which does not surprise me when we go back to the suicide note that Mark wrote about how this, it's like a transgenerational curse almost.
Yeah.
You know, a father to the son to
the
son.
That's what it sounds like for sure.
But every family has their quirks, right? And so these little unusual things about the family that people may have noticed got brushed off. Not one person could say, oh, Mark was X, Y, and Z, and that explains it. And I'm referring to before Deborah's murder, by the way. On the other hand, his day trading buddies had no idea about the suspicion of murder for years, you know, before that. They didn't know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Familicide is a culmination of events. It's the sudden eruption of this pressure cooker that, you know, you can't see what's going on in the inside. But everything's not fine.
Yeah.
It looks fine, but it's not.
Yeah,
and, you know, the spree killing after he kills his family, he had nothing to lose. In his mind, they were to blame for his financial losses. I don't know how he got to that, but often spree killers, you know, they might refer to it as a rampage killing because they have a vendetta or they're very angry with someone or something or an organization of people. Like Dylan Roof. I mean, he was racist real bad walked into an AME church and killed a bunch of African Americans because he just was mad. The Pulse nightclub shooting. You know, these people have vendettas. And as for Mark's ultimate suicide, I believe he was always going to commit suicide. I believe he was...
Yeah, because he couldn't deal with the consequences.
Exactly. You know when you're bowling and you roll the ball and it immediately goes into the gutter? Yeah. Like right there. Like right at the front. And you just stand there and watch it roll all the way. You know it's not going to hit any pins.
That just happened.
But you just watch it roll all the way down. You're like, that's what Mark did. His life was already in the gutter. He's just, in his mind, he was like, I'm just going to ride this out until it ends. And I'll just end it myself. Like, he knew. And it's tragic. Like, there are so many things that could have happened that could have saved all of those lives. It's just, this case is wild. And I told you,
I'm ready. Like, wait, there's more.
Because every, well, and then I found out about his ex-wife, and I was like, oh my Lord. And then that opened a can of worms. So,
well,
we're done, guys. You can never make this kind of thing make sense. It doesn't. None of the cases that we cover make sense to us. It's just insane that it had to go down like this. It had to end like this.
Well, thank you for going on that merry-go-round.
Thanks for hanging in there. I know that was a long one. I hope... you got a potty break, maybe, and you should have done an intermission or something. But thanks so much for listening. And again, stay tuned next week for our birthday surprise.
Well, this was great. Let's do it again sometime.
Let's do it. See you next week, guys.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.
Well, thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying our podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating so that other true crime fans can find us.
If you have any case suggestions or just want to say hey, email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, where we post case photos and information at Cousins on Crime Podcast.